What's up, everyone? This is Mike Cashew, and you're listening to the Brute Strength Podcast. This week, I interviewed functional medicine doctor Ben House. We dive into a lot of different topics on blood work. We talk about different diets, a high-fat diet, the gluten-free myth, and we finish by talking about meditation, mindfulness, and living a wholehearted life. This guy is an absolute genius. There are lots of gems in this one. If you're interested in learning more about all of the free content that we're putting out via video, blog post, free programs, head to the brutestrengthtraining.com website and sign up for our newsletter. Enjoy the show. What's up, guys? This is Mike Cashew, and you're listening to the Brute Strength Podcast. I'm here with holistic doctor Ben House, and I hope I didn't use the wrong word there. You're a functional medicine practitioner.
And the naming that we got, sometimes we get lost in the names, and that's fine.
So, man, I know you're incredibly busy, and I appreciate you making the time to do this. I'm really fired up to kind of talk about some different things than I've ever talked about on here. And I want to start with this. I spent hours going through your blog, and I came across some interesting things like a cock cage, cock punched, and a poop sandwich. So
yes.
You have a great sense of humor. I was laughing the entire time as well as learning. Who are your favorite comedians and why? I feel like you might have a well thought out answer. You seem to have a well thought out answer for about everything.
My favorite comedians? I don't have a well thought out answer for that. I've started writing when I was really young. I found creative writing when I was 21. And so I've just kept writing for really, really long periods of time. And it's just like, I think it's just like training. You have to do it. And for me, I don't know. I have a lot of funny people in my life, like, Dave Roscoe, who's one of my best friends. Like, the guy's, he's a social media guru, and he's just hilarious. And so I think a lot of the humor just comes from conversations in my life. I don't actually watch a lot of TV or movies or anything anymore. So that's kind of weird, but I'm okay being weird.
Nice. Speaking of which, we need, or is there, do you know if there's a social media guru certification yet?
No, that's probably coming. And the guru word is kidding, is bad as well.
Oh man. So you put out a shitload of, as you put it, medium, kind of short to medium length content. And it's very high quality, very easy to read. What's your process? Like, when do you write every day, or do you have a kind of rules as to when you write and how you write?
Yeah, I write at least 20 minutes every day. I try to make the first thing that I do is I sit, so I meditate. And then I write. Sometimes it'll just hit me. Like, I'll just get on my phone, or an idea or analogy will just come, and I'll just start writing right away. But Natalie Goldberg has one of my favorite sayings. It's like, writing is, it's like flying a bike. And the only thing that keeps you in the air is writing. So you got to just keep pedaling. And so a lot of times we like want our writing to be really good, and we want to share it. And like, when I first started writing, my writing was shit, man. It was horrible. And I'm just glad that people like it now, because I don't write for anyone else other than myself. But the short form, people love the short form. And so they love like little, and the short form is really important because it leads to action. And I think a lot of people can get lost in the medium and long form because we only think like we're a good writer if we write a book. And I don't know that that's necessarily true. I think that it's how much you move people. And so I think in this day and age, people's attention spans are pretty short. And so you want to catch them where they're at and get them to change. If you can just plant a seed or move them along that habit continuum, I think that's great.
I love that, man. I started subscribing to Seth Godin's newsletter probably 6 to 9 months ago. And I loved that form. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's like,
yeah,
just tiny tidbits. And so, Adi and I started a blog a while ago, and we just write it like that. Just sometimes they're just a short paragraph. So
yeah, Zen and juice, right?
Exactly.
It was solid.
Exactly. Solid. I saw one of your articles you wrote on consumerism and another one on mindfulness is not second place. So I notice a lot of, I don't know if I'd call it Eastern philosophy or what have you, but I'm wondering what philosophies do you hold or strategies do you have to help you live what I would call a wholehearted life free of too many distractions?
Oh man, I'm a crazy introvert, and so distractions just really like they. So if someone like asks me like how's the weather, and I'm in the middle of writing, it's kind of, I get physically angry. So I think it's setting your environment up for success, but also really getting to my dad. It's kind of unfair, right? Because my dad is a Zen Buddhist. He's an ordained Buddhist priest, whatever you want to call that. And so he got involved in a Zen practice when I was 14. And I thought it was the craziest thing ever. Like, he's going to sit with other human beings. It was like super cultish to me. And then when I was 19, I went. And like most men, I think in our culture, I was maybe that's a broad generalization, but most athletic men, I was a jock. I'm still a meathead. And so I objectified women. I mean, I partied, everything that kind of comes with the territory. And so first time I got on that cushion, it was scary, because you kind of open up, you awaken to all the monkey mind and your craziness. And so I had the opportunity to start that practice early. And so I'm always thankful for that. And so that, it's just like writing. I think we can get lost in that. Meditation is so important. You cannot, whatever it is for you, whatever your mindfulness practice is, whether it's heart math, headspace, whether it's some kind of guided meditation, which is a great intro, or it's just sitting on a cushion alone, solo with your breath. That is your anchor into daily life. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have that, you will start to sway. And every time in my life that I have not sat on a cushion every day, things have kind of whirlwind out of, they've snowballed effect, mm-hmm. kind of out of control. And one of those, my marriage almost went down the tubes. And so I know not to screw that up.
Right. What have you done, maybe intuitively or been taught by your dad, to help the mindfulness practice transfer over to everyday living? Because I know that simply quieting your mind for 20 minutes doesn't necessarily do it for everyone.
Yeah, I think we're ultimately trying to create a gap between our thoughts and our actions. Mm-hmm. I think it just happens with practice. There's no shortcuts, unfortunately. And we all come to practice with different baggages. And I also think like we can get lost in like meditation is the way, but there's no substitute for sitting, right? But make your life meditation. So when you're training, be training. Don't have your phone out there. Don't, like, when you're doing something, do that something. And that I think is how you pay more attention and bring mindfulness in your life, mm-hmm. very, very quickly.
Right. Kind of one of the aha moments for me, when I was, I don't know, 20, 21 years old, is when I would be talking to a friend of mine that made me angry. And then all of a sudden I would say, oh, hey, that's anger. Right. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I wasn't the anger, I was watching the anger. And that was very powerful, because all of a sudden I felt this, I don't know if the right word is control over my emotions, but the lack of attachment to them. And I was just able to let go of, you know, negative emotions a little bit easier. And so I think that once people get a little taste of that kind of stuff, they're hooked.
Yeah, in Zen we call that thoughts and emotions are what the mind does. They just bubble up. Our job is to watch them. So they, mm-hmm. they call it like passing clouds. And so that is our job. You are not your emotions. You are not your thoughts. You are the watcher.
The watcher. Those. Hell yeah. I love that. So let's talk about your medical practice. Can you tell everybody, you know, maybe what your official title is, what kind of doctor you are, and maybe a little bit about your mission?
Yeah, so my mission is really simple right now. I want to bring functional medicine to the strength coach community, because, or gyms in general, just because I think that's how we get ahead of a lot of the chronic diseases that are really wreaking havoc on Western society. And I have a PhD in nutritional sciences. There's a lot of stuff. I was accepted to med school without an undergrad degree. I elected to go into nutrition because my dad got really sick and the medical model could not fix him. He has celiac disease. And so I was like on a walkabout, and I was in Boulder, Colorado, and a guy just happened to give me a book. It was called Breaking the Vicious Cycle. And I was like 21, and I read the book, and it was like it was like hardcore paleo, but you made your own yogurt. And so my dad started making his own yogurt and like gave up rice and crackers, which the doctors were telling him to eat. And he was symptom free in 3 days. And I was like, holy wow. Shit, this is where it's at. And so I got lost in that for a little while. I thought, like, I think sometimes we can the allopathic model versus like we can get in this one, like there's a dichotomy, and I never like dichotomies. They don't work very well. But I would say that I try to find problems before they start. That is how I explain what I do to the general public. So I grab lab work, and I think like, I'm not a licensed medical provider. The only thing I can do is I can provide people with education. And so my consults are 2 hours long. I provide them with all the information that they need to make quality decisions about their health. And so the conventional medicine realm lives in pathologies. And so if you have a disease state, or Mark Hyman calls it the name it, tame it, and blame, or name it, blame it, and tame it. Mm-hmm. And so what we want to do in the functional realm is we don't really care about names. We just want to look for deviations and then try to fix those deviations and get you back to, I hate the word optimal, but get you back to performing your best, right, and feeling your best.
So why bring this into strength and conditioning facilities?
Oh, because it's crazy necessary. So my favorite kind of example is iron. So especially in women, so you need iron it's the central molecule of hemoglobin. It carries around oxygen. So if you don't have iron, if your ferritin level, which is your storage form of iron, is at a 15, and you're a female and you have heavy menstrual cycles, everything you do in the gym is now anaerobic because you can't carry around oxygen. So it doesn't matter what your programming is, you're in a sympathetic state. No, maybe if you're even walking down the street, right? And so it's addressing these things that strength coaches, why is this person not getting results? Is it they need more volume? Are they not following their diet? Or is it just something physiological that we don't have on board? And so that's my goal, is to just how we brought a lot of PT practices and DB, physical therapists will kind of argue that maybe this isn't in the strength coach's realm. And we can argue a lot about scope of practice, but the fact is that we are in just a shit storm from a general public standpoint. So there's not enough people to handle all the problems that we're dealing with. So we need more educated people so that can just start, the change that needs to happen.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you're in the CrossFit community, you know how fired up those coaches are, as well as a lot of the, less traditional strength and conditioning coaches in collegiate and professional realms. You know how fired up they are about gaining knowledge and being able to serve their people. Right. So What if, you know, if they're listening to this and they're fired up to go out there and learn, what should they seek out? What education should they be looking for? All of that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So the fundamentals. So I think the fundamentals are the most important. So if we think about 90%, I love the quote from Marcus Aurelius, like we need more often to be reminded than informed. So a lot of what I do is just remind people to do simple shit. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, you need to sleep. Hey, you need to eat real food. Hey, you need to have some kind of mindfulness practice in your life. And so you need to move, and because movement fires up the brain. And if people want to learn more about functional medicine, it's not something like, just like PT, like you can't dabble, because if you dabble, you're dangerous. And so if you want to go, you got to go all the way. But that's not to say that you can't learn the fundamentals and then point people in the right direction. And that's how I see most gyms doing this, is like, okay, in your onboarding process, we're going to get you this lab work that we have that everyone get. And then if things are off, if things are really bad, right, we have to get you to a medical provider. Mm-hmm. But if things are not so bad, we just like how you did, if someone came in and they had, you know, 5 herniated discs, you wouldn't like put them on a barbell right away. You would have some kind of process where you would triage them into different scopes. And so I think of a highway. And so you get all your people get on this on ramp. And then where they go, I don't know. But you should have a lot of different methodologies to figure out where they go. Mm-hmm.
So with this blood work, is there a good website or protocol that people can look into to give to their kind of incoming members?
Yeah. So I think we're going to start to see the gatekeepers leave their gates as far as like getting labs. The Life Extension is a great, you can get in 47 states in the U.S., you can just go on Life Extension and order whatever panel you want. Now you're going to get those results and you're not going to necessarily, it's going to be gibberish to you. So that's not very helpful. There has to be the first place for coaches and anyone who wants to be involved in functional med is they have to learn blood chemistry. And so when they learn blood chemistry, they're going to learn, it's going to kind of diffuse into everything that they do. And I think that's the first point. And so there's a lot of great places to learn about functional blood chemistry. There's a lot of books. Alex Vasquez has a huge 1,200-page textbook if you really want to nerd out. There's a lot of seminars on it. The problem is you need kind of credentials to get into a lot of the seminars, but I think we might see that start to fade as well. And so those are, I think, if I can link out some books for you at the end, and then also some educational materials that people would want to look through.
Yeah, that would be awesome. We'll put those in the show notes. People that are looking for a good doctor in their area, right? A functional medicine doctor that's going to help them, you know, deal with their issues at the root. What kind of questions should they ask the doctor, or what kind of search terms should they even put in the Google machine to find the right kind of doctor?
That's a problem, and that's something I hope to remedy. So right now we have IFM, which is the Institute of Functional Medicine. That was founded by Jeffrey Bland, who's just a pioneer. And so that is a one route. You can go to the IFM website and find practitioners who've gone through their certification. You also have like a search engine called like Primal Docs. But the problem is for most MDs, most people in the functional medicine realm, they don't understand athletes very well. There's only a few that I've met that understand the athletic process. And so athletes can get really screwed up you can go into a functional medicine practitioner and feel broken. And that's not helpful. Like if you're trying to get to the games, I can't tell an athlete like, hey, I need you to not train for 2 months. Like it's not going to work. Right. Mm-hmm. And we also have to respect that when we exercise, we do damage to the body. So your blood urea nitrogen levels might be, if you haven't taken time off, your kidney function may look bad. It may be fine, but it may look bad on labs. You may show like not like crazy elevated liver enzymes, but your liver enzymes might be a little bit high. Your bilirubin might be a little bit high. So you can kind of get pushed as an athlete. If you don't go to the wrong person, you can get pushed into the chronic disease bucket mm-hmm. when you don't really have any kind of chronic diseases. And so that's why I think that as this profession expands, the biggest thing is fine, because functional medicine is very new. And so we have to find the right person, the right practitioner, the right doctor for the right person. And that is incredibly important. So mm-hmm. I tend to be the right person for a lot of male athletes. And then female athletes I work with as well. But I refer those out to another practitioner, Brenda Gregory, who's just wicked smart. And so we need referral networks even inside of functional med, and it's going to grow. It's going to get bigger. And I think if we have more athletes that get in the space, it's going to get better and better.
Awesome, man. Let's talk about diet a little bit. One article you wrote was talking about, I think it was called low fat diet part one or something like that. And you're high fat diet.
That couldn't have been a title. That's a bad title.
I love it. It sucked me right in. So yeah, talking about a high fat, low carb diet. And one of the first sources you referenced said something to the effect that the vast majority of literature shows a decrease in performance of high intensity exercise with in terms of low carb diets, meaning low carb diet oftentimes leads to lower performance. And, we might be beating a dead horse with this because this is growing. This topic has been growing for the last year or so in the CrossFit community. But what's the current research and opinion on high fat diets for performance?
Man, it's such a can of worms right there. And I love it. I love it. I'm deep in the heart of that right now. And I think we'll be arguing this for a very long time. We love extremes in the dietary world. No one likes to be in the middle. Let's just care about adherence. Let's care about the fundamentals. That doesn't sell books. Even in the CrossFit community, we've seen a lot of pendulum swings. So we saw paleo was the first thing to sprout. And then all of a sudden people realize holy shit, we're getting overtrained. We got to do something else. And then zone came in and now we're going to go to 40% carbs. Right. And so now it was a paleo, but it was higher carbs, and they still had this weird, this block formation thing. And I did a lot of I looked at a lot of the blocks and I was like, man, this female is training really hard and she's getting 1600 calories. This can't be right. Just looking at a macros perspective, I think of food in three realms. So we have food quality, we have food quantity, and we have nutrient timing. And I listened to the supplement podcast that you guys did, and I think we can get lost in making just rationalizations. And so if we poke food quality, which is what in CrossFit, which we like to poke, which is great. It's the first thing I poke, if we put people on a paleo diet, what's going to happen to their food quantity?
It's going to go down.
Yeah, right. Their caloric, you eat clean, your caloric consumption is going to go down inevitably. Now that can be a good thing if you're with a weight loss client and they're going to feel more full. They can't even eat all their food and kind of they'll lose weight and they won't even feel like they're trying. But it can be bad too, because if you have an athlete that is just crushing it and they're training 3 hours a day, the number one way for me to induce the female athlete triad is to not give them enough calories, right? And so we have to be cognizant of when we poke one thing, we're going to poke the other. Now, if I poke two things, which seems to be happening a lot right lately, I'm going to poke food quantity or food quality. So you're going to eat very, very clean. And then I'm going to intermittent fast you. So I'm going to close down your food window. Now I've done, if I do that, what's going to happen to caloric consumption?
Go down again.
Yeah, there's no way. If I put an athlete in an 8-hour window and they don't get sweet potatoes, they don't get tubers, they don't even get rice, there's no way they're going to meet their caloric demands. And now if I put a male and they're 15% lower than their caloric demands, their testosterone function will go down, their thyroid function will probably go down. So there's a lot of things that you're going to cause, and the fastest way I think to overtrain an athlete is just to start just poking on their diet and not have any just cognizant thoughts about what else is going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so from a keto standpoint, the keto folks, I have a huge amount of respect for a lot of, Mike Mutzel he's another person in the space who's really, really good. He has a great podcast. And he is he's very, very keto right now. And all the research that we have is in carbohydrate using athletes. And so that's important to think about, is if you're using carbohydrates as your fuel source, you're never, carbohydrates are like NOS. You're never going to be able to fuel Fran on fat. It's not going to happen. Fran is not getting fueled on ketones. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to push the gas pedal, you're going to want carbohydrates.
You just blew a lot of people's minds with that one, by the way. You will not fuel Fran with ketones.
And so it's, you're definitely not – this is all comes back to metabolic flexibility by Dr. Mike T. Nelson. So our goal is to be able to dispose of glucose as quickly as possible. Our goal is to be able to use the shit out of glucose. And then if we're more – so think about how I always explain metabolic flexibility is think of diabetes. That person cannot deal with copious amounts of glucose very well. They can't put it away, right? They're insulin resistant. But they also can't fast. They can't deal with fats very well. So what we want to do is we want people to become more metabolically flexible so that they can deal with copious amounts of glucose and they can also burn fat when they're fasting so that they don't get hangry, they don't get hypoglycemic, right? And that is the biggest – you will not see a lot of insulin resistance in your athletes. You're not going to see it. You will see a lot of insulin resistance in the general population. What you're going to see with athletes is you're going to see hypoglycemia. You're going to see this tendency to drop low. And so that anytime we have five hormones that raise blood sugar and we only have one hormone that puts sugar away. So our body does not want to drop low on blood sugar. And all of those hormones to raise blood sugar, they're all stress hormones. Well, the majority of them. Mm-hmm. The first one that we use is cortisol. And then when cortisol is depleted, we break out the big duns like norepi and epi or adrenaline. And so that's when people start waking up in the middle of the night and their heart's racing and they can't fall back asleep. And so how did you induce that? I don't know. But that's something that we have to think about. And so our goal is to make athletes more metabolically flexible. And now here's a question for you. Where do we, as human beings, like where do we put sugar?
Fuck me. Somewhere in the cell.
You're a big fucking dude, man. Like where are you putting that cupcake if you eat it?
Most of it goes in my ass. some in the chest maybe.
Yeah. So your muscles, right?
Right.
So if you're a male and you have a lot of lean body mass, that I think of I think of a sink. And so if you're a male and you have a ton of muscle mass, you're gonna have a pretty big sink. And your drain is exercise. So how much sugar people can deal with is very, very individualized. If I have a 65-year-old female and she's never trained in her life, she's got like a teacup, man. And so if I give that lady a Skittle, she's going to freak the fuck out, right? Her blood sugar is going to go high. And whenever blood sugar goes high, we can get things – bad things happen. Like you damage your nephrons. You blow up brain cells. Like we don't want sugar to go too high. We also don't want sugar to drop low because it's a stressor. And so I think it's all about individualizing carb intake. And whenever I make diet plans, and this is something that I wanted to like scream inside that podcast is, so you start with protein, and this is just the fundamentals, right? So you start with protein, and then you find out what their carbohydrate, what they need for their goals. You figure out their carbohydrates.
What do you mean you start with protein?
So any kind of athlete is going to want to be somewhere around 1 gram per pound, probably actually a little bit less. And that is what we need to meet to maintain muscle mass and to grow. Mm-hmm. Past that, you're not going to get much benefit unless your digestive tract is too super screwed from eating more protein. So the first thing that we have to address is protein content. And for most male athletes, they eat way too much protein. And then that means they eat less carbohydrates and less fat, which are actually usable for them. So the most males will need between, depending on if you use shakes or not, which is another thing they talked about in that podcast. Nutrient timing has kind of gotten blown up in the last 10 years. What matters more is overall consumption. And then on top of that, like just the amount of protein that you eat in a day. And obviously you want that to be in like 3 to 5 boluses. But I don't think people need to be like hooked up to gummy bears and shakes right after they train. Maybe if you go in fasted, that's important. But I think the big thing is just looking at how much protein are people eating over the day and then how many calories are they getting and then where are those calories coming from?
Gotcha. So how do you increase metabolic flexibility?
Yeah. What is the way to – so you answer that question. Like if I want somebody – if I want that sink to be bigger, what do I do?
Well, you want to build lean muscle mass.
Boom.
And if I remember correctly, scouring through the Poliquin archives, I think he teaches to, you know, start out with a very clean, almost paleo-ish diet, like very high protein diet, and then slowly introduce carbohydrates back into the system.
Yeah, that's exactly what we do. So we figure out people's carb tolerances. You can also use things like, this is where you have to be careful, because you use things like intermittent fasting. So what are the things that are going to make people more insulin sensitive? Their training, and then fasting is another great tool. But we want to be, with athletes, you want to make sure to block that. So I don't want you fasting in, I don't want you not eating food in your hardest training cycle. Maybe on a deload week, you can fast for 12 or 16 hours, but not when you're going through, not when you're hard of it.
Right. So what about a high fat diet for overall health?
Yeah. High fat diets are really, really popular right now. They're gaining a lot of traction. And so I would implore people to look at the other realm. And so that's Alan Aragon, Brad Schoenfeld, Krieger, a lot of guys that are just really, really smart folks who are just preaching this more like kind of middle road. And so from a keto perspective, ketogenic diets can be very helpful for a variety of reasons and for a variety of health kind of, if you have epilepsy, you should probably not have a lot of carbohydrates. You should probably be ketogenic. And I think there's a lot of really, really smart people who are in the keto field, and there's a lot of benefits. You're going to keep insulin really low. Okay. That seems like a good idea, right? Insulin's bad, correct or not correct?
Insulin is not bad.
Insulin's not bad. So yes. So that is, so the ketogenic, like a lot of like eat fat, get thin, like that premise is built on insulin being bad. Like insulin is how we store fat. And so if you drop insulin off the table, you're not going to be able to store fat. But that's not true. Like they've done metabolic ward studies, and ketogenic diets don't perform any better than higher carb diets. Mm-hmm. And so metabolic ward studies, like no one wants to do. You live in like a little bomb calorimeter, like you don't light on fire, but you live in like a whole room calorimeter for multiple weeks or multiple days. And they just measured your metabolism. And so you're not going to lose weight any faster. That's not necessarily true. So in a controlled metabolic ward type environment, you will lose weight generally at the same speed on a high carb versus a high fat diet. If in the free living population, you tend to lose weight faster with a ketogenic diet, and this goes away in the long term trials, it tends to go away at about a year or 2 years, like no matter what diet you're on. Mm-hmm. And the number one rule in nutrition is adherence. So if someone can adhere to a ketogenic diet, and you look at their blood markers and their lipids are great, their fasting blood sugar looks phenomenal, and they're not doing a ton of high intensity exercise, they're probably going to do pretty well. But if we have an athlete who gets into a ketogenic diet and they get into some really weird disordered eating patterns, like they're keto for 3 days and then they just go pound margaritas and cupcakes.
Right.
And that's what I see most often. We have it's not a healthy relationship with food. Like people try to clean up their diet way too much. They have this dichotomous relationship with food, and they create just a weird, their body wants carbohydrates. So then your body's going to get what it wants. And so that I think is important to talk about. And not a lot of people want to talk about that, is if you're inducing a disordered eating pattern by what you're telling people, that's not good.
Right. And then lastly, on the topic of these diets, how do they relate to testosterone production? I know that, or at least I think I know that low fat diets can lead to some problems in testosterone. So how does all that relate?
Yeah. So the problem is, I went to University of Texas, and obviously that's a largely funded university, and we're not going to see a lot of research on this. And that's unfortunate. Maybe we'll see more as it gets more popular, but research has to be involved in like a medical. So, and athletes don't get a lot of credence in the research realm. And so if we think about in the keto folks' mind, everything needs to be changed, because if you're keto adapted, the entire metabolism changes. And I'm not saying they're wrong. I'm just saying we don't know yet. And so from a testosterone standpoint, and I love talking male health, I could talk about it for hours. So testosterone is, people love, it's like a bench press number. Like, man, yo, bro, what's your serum testosterone? And so when we think about, I always go back to this ancestral viewpoint. And so what is the most expensive thing that we could do as a tribe of humans? It's kind of a, I always like to ask really weird questions.
Oh, fuck. What is the most expensive thing?
What's the most expensive thing we could do as a?
I would say we all go to the moon.
Yeah. So that would be expensive. I don't know that a bunch of Paleolithic tribes, that would be expensive. But within their realm of possibilities, there's kind of a couple things that our old ancestors would have done, and for the majority of human history. So I always like to think of a football field. And so for 99.5 yards of that football field, we did not have agriculture. And then for 0.5, we had agriculture. And then for like the last centimeters, we've had the Industrial Revolution. And so most of our, what we're adapted as human animals to do is based on kind of ancestral viewpoint. And so the most expensive things we could probably do are go to war with another tribe. And then the really most expensive thing we could do is make a baby. Because babies are useless, and they're useless till they're about 12. We just, as humans, we have to provide for them until, you know, they're mid teenage years. And so we can imagine that the human animal would have wanted to turn down fertility if they were stressed out, if there was in a starvation state, or if they were going to war, right? And so I think of it, and if we think globally and then we dial into the research, we can see that, and we don't have a lot of long-term trials. Like acutely, if you put someone on a long-term diet or a low-carb diet and then you give them a bunch of high-intensity exercise, testosterone goes, you smash it in the face. Mm-hmm. But we don't have a lot of long-term trials. My hypothesis is that the brain rules all to me. And so there's a lot of energy sensing mechanisms in the brain. There's a lot of energy sensing mechanisms that we just don't even know yet. And some of the biggest one is probably leptin. And so when the leptin is our fuel gauge, and so when we lose body fat, leptin's gonna go down and that's gonna tell us to eat. And leptin also is found to be, energy sensing has been found to be related to a lot of these axes related to thyroid function and related to fertility. And that's critical because you need thyroid hormone for cholesterol to even enter into the testicles. And then you obviously need gonadotropin-releasing hormone and then luteinizing hormone for to stimulate the testicles to produce testosterone. And both of those are under the brain's control.
Wow. You blew my mind with the like strategy to not make babies part. I've never heard that kind of theory. I love it.
Yeah, I think it's really true in women. And I think it's evident that the fastest way to induce like the amenorrhea, right, is to train women into, maybe it's not the fastest, but the fastest would be to obviously give them a hysterectomy. But the fastest would be to train them and not give them enough calories. So mm-hmm. put them in a starvation state and a ton of stress. Right. And then they're going to lose their ability to make a baby.
It's wild. Okay, let's talk about gluten-free for a second. How many people that are newly gluten-free, and it's going to be hard to give you a percentage. I just want to kind of talk about this. How many people do you think are actually completely fine with gluten? Maybe by going gluten-free, right, they thought they were maybe had celiac disease or had some issues, and then they went gluten-free. How many do you think just put themselves into a gluten sensitivity state or a gluten sensitive state? And so now that when they try to reintroduce gluten, they just have, you know, some adverse reaction, but they're not actually, you know, gluten intolerant.
So that's a great question. That's another pendulum inside of a lack of understanding, I think, in the general population about like what, like you ask somebody like, what is gluten? And they're like, oh, well, it's bad for me. And you're like, okay, cool. But that's getting better. So gluten is just a dietary protein. and our immune system can attack any protein that is 10 to 15 amino acids in length, and it can recognize it and tag it and create a reaction to it. And so gluten, I think of the gluten that we have now as like being like space wheat. And so like human beings have never seen this shit because it's literally brand new. And so, yeah, it makes sense that we would have problems digesting it. But if you've watched Cooked by Michael Pollan, you know, like back in the day, there was actually very little gluten in bread because they used bacteria and the bacteria ate gluten. So if you have like unleavened sourdough, you might be fine. Now, the placebo effect is very, very real. And so here's a question for you. If I poke someone, if I take out gluten from their diet, I poke their food quality, what did I inevitably do? What did they eat less of?
Less gluten, no gluten.
Yeah, what did they eat? Less carbs, right? They eat less bread, and then what did they eat more of?
Protein and fat.
Yeah, so they're going to be more satiated. They're probably going to feel better. They're probably going to eat more vegetables, right? It's the same thing like when someone goes vegan. Oh, yeah, you went from eating cheeseburgers to eating a bunch of vegetables. No shit, you feel better.
Right.
And so from a – I like – let's get pretty deep in there because I think your listeners are super, super fucking smart. And so – I just like to pay some credence to that digestive track. I was a nutritional sciences my entire life. And so you have the most amazing GI track. And I think we like to throw this thing under the bus.
I do?
No, like we, everybody, every human, like you have the most amazing GI track. So you have a stomach that is 3 million times more acidic than arterial blood. Hydrochloric acid is 600 times more expensive than any other compound. If your stomach broke open, it would literally eat you alive. You have the digestive tract. Your small intestine is one of a carnivorous animal. It's very sterile. It only has about a 10 to the third microbial population. Then you have a large intestine, which is that of like more like a ruminant animal, which can digest carbohydrates, and it has a microbial population around 10 to the 11th. So like numbers that we can't even fathom. And so like we like to think that this system doesn't know what the fuck it's doing. This system knows what it's doing. And the problem is that we piss it off and we don't respect it. And we piss it off by modern living. And so our immune, like when you talk about the GI tract and we talk about gluten, you have to get into immunology, and nobody wants to talk about immunology because immunology is complicated. And so my favorite analogy for this, and this is from a guy by Dr. Tom Culleton, who's just an amazing speaker. And so Coach, you're having a party. We'll just get into it. So you're having a party at your house. You got a new house in Austin, and you're having a party there. And you have two groups of friends over at this party. So who are your two groups of friends?
Oh, I don't know what you're talking about.
So you got yeah. So like, just make some like.
We got the CrossFitters and we got the business folks.
Okay, so you got your business folks and you got your CrossFitters. And who would be like more likely to just be tanked out of their mind?
The business folks.
Okay, so your business folks, they're 12 drinks deep. They're just absolutely obliterated. And then your CrossFit folks are like, they're like 4 drinks deep. And so you are having – this party's raging. Everybody's having a good time. And then someone that you don't like, what are their general features? You obviously don't have to name any names, but like, what do they look like?
Damn, that's a tough question. What do they
look like? Or you just make somebody up.
Yeah, they're tall. They have curly hair, curly dark hair, for God's sake. Okay. And a big nose.
All right. So you got this tall dude, male. Tall,
yeah,
male.
Definitely.
Curly black hair and a giant nose. So he walks in your party and you're like, fuck that. He's not coming to my party. So you tell your drunk business friends, you're like, hey, I want you to kick the shit out of this dude. And they beat the shit out of him. And in this party now, all of a sudden, like, your house is just – your new place is just getting wrecked. Like walls are smashed. Everything's just getting blasted. And so in the middle of this melee, you tag homeboy with a dart. So you got this – for some reason, you got this pink dart gun. And you're like ding, ding, ding. And you nail this dude in the shoulder with a pink dart. And so everything calms down. You spend the next 3 weeks cleaning your GI tract, like cleaning your house up, fixing everything. And so then you have another party. And everything's fine. Everybody's a little bit kind of – they're on edge a little bit. But you got another party in 3 weeks. And this dude comes back again. And you're like, fuck this dude. I can't believe that you would come to my party again. And your CrossFit friends, who are obviously more big and more badass than your business friends, they respond to pink darts. and they just go apeshit. And they destroy your entire, like, things just go crazy, right? Mm-hmm. And so in this situation, in this analogy, like, who is the problem?
Who is the problem? I really don't know.
So who's initiating all of this?
Me.
You are. You're the first person ever to get that. Most people want to blame the person coming in their party. You are. You're telling, that's amazing. You're telling people to fight. You're breaking out that dart gun and tagging people with darts. And so you're a T-Rex though. And so the problem is,
what did you say I am? I'm a T-Rex?
T-Rex cell, a regulatory T cell.
Got it.
That's for the immunology folks. And so your job is essentially, you want to be tolerant of your environment. That is the whole, we want our immune system to be like the kid on the playground who's just jacked and like gives zero fucks. Like, right. You could poke him, he doesn't care. Whereas if your immune system's like the little twerp who's like super overreactive, like reacts to everything, you don't want that from an immune system. Mm-hmm. And so for you, gluten is the guy coming in your house. Now, why the hell are we starting a fight with gluten? Well, because gluten is going to cause intestinal permeability in every human. We know that from research. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to cause an immunological response. And what we don't want is, we don't want the immune system to get intolerant. And how – here's kind of a question. How does our immune system gain tolerance? How do we become okay with the outside world?
We introduce whatever it is into the system more and more often.
Perfect. Yeah. And so this, now we get really deep. So now we go back to birth and we go back to conception. So we go, did you have a vaginal birth or did you have a cesarean section birth? Were you bottle fed? Were you breastfed? Because as a baby human animal, you don't have an immune system until you're about two. So that is when you really, your immune system becomes tolerant or not tolerant. And I always like to think of the ends of the spectrum. So the worst thing that we can become intolerant of is ourselves. And so that is like autoimmune conditions where all of a sudden your body is not tolerating its own tissue. And so that would be like an autoimmune disease. And we know the portal for autoimmunity is intestinal permeability. So now you just got a ton of protein. Basically, if we go back to that party analogy, your doors are ripped wide open, your windows are wide open, and you got just a ton of weird looking folks coming to your party. And now you got to calm everything down, but everybody's going to want to fight. Mm-hmm. And so that's the analogy that I use. And so gluten is just, it's a protein that we're not used to seeing. It's can cause a lot of problems in some people. That doesn't mean that everyone suffers from non-celiac gluten sensitivity. It doesn't mean that everyone needs to avoid gluten. I do think that most, if you have digestive symptoms, you should try avoiding it and seeing if it's better. And then if it's the placebo, really, who gives a shit? You can get testing. I do Cyrex testing, which tests for the darts. That's one way to, that's IgG and IgA testing. And so that's one way to look. But I think you have to ask more than the gluten question. You can't just stop at like the gluten question. You gotta dig deeper.
Mm-hmm. Love it, man. That is a phenomenal analogy. And just for the record, I'm totally cool with tall people with dark curly hair. So I know there's a couple of guys out there really down on themselves, but you don't have to be. Let's talk about testosterone for a second. You're big into figuring out everything else before going to a T replacement clinic, such as lifestyle changes. What does the general population need to be aware of in terms of preventing themselves from developing low T in terms of lifestyle changes?
Yeah, that's a great question. So if we think about everything that really just knocks down manliness in general. We have stress, which my acronym for this is SENSE. So we have stress, we have estrogen, we have nutrition. So a lot of people don't really think about your Leydig cells die as you age, right? And your Leydig cells are what produce testosterone. So cells normally die because there's too much oxidative stress. And so we want to make sure that our diet is full of antioxidants, right? Leydig cells don't die as fast.
What's that word you're saying? Leydig.
Leydig cells, L-E-Y-D-I-G. Those are the cells in your testicles that make testosterone.
Got it.
Pretty important little guys. Then you have Sertoli cells, which make sperm. And so LH is the signal molecule for, and I gave a talk at PaleoFX this past year about the hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis, because that's really what we're talking about. And I think in order to really understand this axis, we have to understand that it is where we can have problems in the axis, from even if we get into lifestyle. So remember, the brain rules all. And so you can have what's called primary hypogonadalism inside the medical model. And that's where, like, you would have blunt trauma to your testicles and your testicles just wouldn't work, or you had testicular cancer. It's fairly rare. You could also have like a variceal, which is kind of a problem with the blood vessels that go to the testicles. And so those are all things that a medical doctor would obviously check for. And then you can have a problem at the brain. And so that it would be called secondary or tertiary, depending on where it is, pituitary or hypothalamus. That would be called secondary or tertiary hypogonadalism. And that is where I think we can really – so we can – in the functional medicine realm, we have to be careful, because we can't make everything into a functional medicine problem. Sometimes if you've had an athlete that maybe a football player, there's a lot of football players who love to train, they've had multiple concussions. And so if you've had a front to back concussion, you can literally, like, your pituitary is on a stalk. And so if you've had a front to back concussion, we know that testosterone will be affected acutely. Now, will that axis turn back on? Maybe, maybe not. But that's something that you always want to check that the male can produce testosterone. That's really, really important. Because if they can't produce testosterone, then it's not really – none of your lifestyle stuff is going to necessarily work, because their parts don't work. And that's important. Also, I have to understand anabolics, because anabolics, as much as we don't want to think that they're a part of sport, they are a very big part of sport. And so if you give an exogenous hormone, you inevitably – it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's insulin, whether it's thyroid hormone, doesn't matter – your body will turn down its own endogenous, or within itself, its own production of that hormone. So you can essentially – bodybuilders know this. They have so much knowledge of this subject that they have other things that they use. Like, they use Clomid, they use HCG, so that their axis doesn't necessarily shut off. Now, if we're just talking about general population, things that you want to do. So you want to eat more vegetables. Let's keep it simple. You want to not stress. You want to have some kind of mindfulness practice. You do not want to get low on sleep. We know that just having 1 5-hour night, you're going to reduce testosterone by like 30%. So, like, don't do that. The fastest way to get TRT is, like, overtrain yourself and don't sleep for a week, and then go get your testosterone tested. You can get some Jack if you want to. So don't do those things. But if fixing those things doesn't work for you, we have to think, like, why? We have to ask deeper questions, and we have to dig deeper. Because you can't ethically leave a male at a testosterone of 250. Like, it's just not ethical, because they're number one, testosterone it's what makes us men. It feeds our frontal lobes. It motivates us. And so that's not good. So I think there's a time and a place for TRT. I just think that we need to be way, way more judicious with how we use it. Because TRT it's generally an EFT, so which means that, like, anyone who's on it, you're on it for life. And because you're not getting off if you're on testosterone especially if you're an older male and you're on it for a long period of time. So we have to, if we're going to use that hammer, we better make damn sure that they need it.
Right.
Is that helpful?
Very helpful. Thank you. Love that. Got a couple more questions for you before we wrap it up. You talk a lot about learning and the way that you learn, the way that the general population learns in general. In your opinion, what makes a great teacher?
Oh, man. I've had the opportunity to see some of the best teachers, and I don't take this lightly. I taught the MCAT prep course when I was like 21, and I had to go through like a really rigorous teaching program for that. And then I went and I taught at KIPP, and that's called the Knowledge is Power program. It's like part of TFA. And so I taught there for 6 months, and I taught high needs high school biology. And so those are two, like, the best experiences of my life. Like, if I was single male, And I wanted to stress out, I would probably go back to high school teaching just because I think I just, there's a lot of help that can be done there. But when we think about teaching, we have to allow, there's a couple things that we have to allow for. We have to allow for independent thought. So we have to challenge people and we have to allow them to fail. And we have to get the fuck out of the way, right? And so you got to give people concepts, you got to allow them to chew it, and then you got to get out of the way. And I think of myself as, with all of this functional med stuff, what I know doesn't really matter. Like the content in my head, if you have a monotone voice, like some of the smartest people in the world are horrible lecturers, they're horrible teachers. And that's because they can't motivate people and they can't like explain things in complex processes in simple ways. And the other thing is if you ask questions, you have to be okay with silence. And I might not have done a good job with that in this podcast, is just wait 15 seconds. So if you want to be a good teacher, ask the audience a question and never answer your own questions.
Right.
You can reframe them, but just wait, just let the silence sit and be like, I'm not going to help you, dude. Just figure it out. You can give me a wrong answer. It's fine. And then you have to make an environment where being wrong is applauded. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that way that when you do like group think and group learning activities, which probably aren't the best way for people to learn. People tend to, this is in the talent code. People tend to learn better when they take things alone and they work on them alone. And so I think that you're never going to learn functional med from going to a weekend retreat. You're never going to do that. You're going to learn, you're going to learn a lot of concepts, and then you need to take that shit home and you need to use it.
I love that, man. So that is great. My last question, what do you want to make absurd in 20 years? And I'm not sure if you've heard any of my other podcasts, so I'll give you an example. 20 years ago, it was commonplace for a grocery store clerk to be smoking as you check out. 20 years ago, or today it's absurd. 20 years ago, it was also commonplace to throw entire bags of trash out of your window. And now in most places, and I always say that in most places because in Louisiana, it's still going on, but in most places it's now absurd. So what do you want to make absurd in 20 years?
I think that just in information in general will just become more and more available. Like for instance, I'm so much of a biohacker that I want to buy a continuous glucose monitor that literally plugs into my stomach and I can watch my glucose all day long for 7 days. But right now I need a prescription for that. And I have to ask one of my MD friends to write me an order, and it costs me about $850, and that'll last me a month.
Mm-hmm.
I think in 20 years, you're going to have a little thing that goes like maybe in the back of your ear that is constantly measuring like bioinformatics, and it's just going to get wild. And I'm so excited for that because information is, it's important and it's also dangerous. And so I think that this is like Apple's going there. A lot of really cool companies are going there. And so the amount that we know is just going to, it's going to increase so fast. And who knows if I gave you this podcast in a year, 2 years, 5 years, what I say might be completely different, but I think what's important is the process. So as this thing just explodes, right? You might be wrong now, but let's see. And we're probably not very wrong. We're probably on the right track, but you got to keep learning. You can't stop learning. And you know this from strength and conditioning. You can't be caught. Like some of that stuff that we did from Bulgarian weightlifting study programming works, right? But it doesn't work for everybody. So that's what I think is going to be absurd. Just the amount of information people are going to get and then what they're going to be able to do with it is going to be pretty cool.
Everybody's going to have a chance to optimize their performance and their life in general then.
Yeah, but we also end up, you can also get kind of conspiracy theory is like, if now all of a sudden, if you eat a cupcake, are you going to have like some red light go off and like three guys are going to take you away?
Right. I don't know. So, by then they're going to have created, a pill that allows us to eat a cupcake, but we don't, but it, our body doesn't register them as carbs at all. That's what I want to make absurd. All right, man. Where can people find you online, on the social medias, and what do you want them to know about?
So I'm on Facebook is where I put out content 4 to 5 days a week. You can just friend me, follow me, whatever. I also put out,
and that's just Ben House on Facebook.
Yeah, you can just search Ben House on Facebook. My website is functionalmedicinecostarica.com. Yes, I do live part-time in Costa Rica. And then my other things that I do have Instagram, I'm somewhat active on Instagram, but it's just kind of for fun because that's kind of what Instagram is. And then the other thing I would tell if there's CrossFitters out there, my wife is, I'll give you a plug. She's absolutely amazing, as most husbands probably say their wives are. But my wife is, we call her Insta-famous. She is Casa_Colibri, which is a hummingbird house. And she has multiple books on how to do handstands. And she's been on like Cosmo. She can like do the dishes in a handstand. And so people should check that out, especially if you want to get better at handstands, because she's going to tell you how to do it the right way.
That's awesome, man. Well, thank you so much, brother. I really appreciate this. This has been great.
Yeah, it was super enjoyable. And I have to say that I think that, no homo, you have the best voice in all of podcasts.
Adi, he just said, no homo, you have the best voice in all of the podcast world. She tells me that every day.
It's good.
Thank you, Ben. I appreciate it, man. We'll talk soon.
Awesome. Have a great day.
You too.